and drinks and snacks. Also, get a chance to tour our legendary station. The First Friday Art Walk is in Portland's vibrant East Side Arts District and includes more than 23 galleries. Hop just around the corner to the Art Walk event at the Jupiter Hotel. You can find a map of participating galleries at firstfridaypdx.org. So come out to KBOO in the name of art, music, and drinks. Friday, November 1st from 6 to 9 p.m. See you then!
Supported free radio station KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. And the latest news is the White House is unhappy about it, but the House has voted to formalize impeachment processes against Trump. And the vote is being carried live on various news organizations. And the last that I have is that the resolution has passed 232 to 196, clearing the way for public hearings. And I understand that they are likely to start around the 11th of November. So it'll be back to the days of Senator Sam Ervin and the impeachment hearings live on television. And I am looking forward to that. Every House Republican present oppose the measure, but it has passed. It's on. Impeachment is formal. This is the day. So how about that? From Julia Conley, writing in Common Dreams, over 50 young climate activists from California staged a sit-in at the Capitol office of Nancy Pelosi yesterday. Chastising the Democratic Speaker of the House, she writes, for failing to act boldly on climate change, even as their home state is engulfed by wildfires made worse by the planetary crisis. Speaking for myself, I was watching some of that live on, I think it was CBS News, and the, pardon me, the anchor caught the on-site reporter off guard by saying, "What is causing what? How is climate change making this worse?" And he did his best. He kind of spluttered. But climate change is making it worse. It rained harder in California because there's more moisture in the air, because there's more heat in the air, and the plants grew faster and thicker, and now the winds are blowing harder from the same dynamics. There's more energy in the atmosphere and more moisture, although that moisture is ironically sucked out of that part of California, and they really are in trouble. After taking over Dianne Feinstein's office earlier in the day, the climate activists from the Sunrise Movement proceeded to Pelosi's office, where they displayed signs reading, "What is your plan?" and saying, "Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys?" That one, I imagine. "Democratic leadership is failing to treat this like the emergency that it is." That's a quote from organizer Claire Teixeira Morrison. She said, "Business as usual is killing us." Several young people shared their personal stories and pleas for Pelosi to back bold climate action, which could drastically reduce and eventually eliminate climate warming carbon emissions. Firefighters across the state, one protester said, and this is a quote, are trying to contain some of the fastest moving fires that we've seen on the West Coast. While Pelosi is putting the lives of Californians and U.S. citizens in continued and escalating danger by not rising to meet the active dangers posed by climate change. End quote. According to climate scientists, the warming of the planet has been accelerated by the hundreds of billions of tons of carbon released every year by oil and gas companies, is making extreme weather changes and events more frequent, leading to a longer wildfire season in California. "We have fires all the time in Los Angeles," Mayor Eric Garcetti told Democracy Now! Recently. But our ability to knock them in past years was much stronger because we didn't have these extreme shifts of wind. We didn't have these extreme shifts of water, of weather. Scientists say the climate crisis has made the state's wildfires five times as dangerous. I was turned on to an article in The Nation by local activist Amy Sitars. Part of it says, it's by John Washington. Part of it says corporations like Accenture, Boeing, Elbit, G-Force, General Dynamics, IBM, L3 Technologies, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Palantir, with software provided by Amazon, Raytheon, and Unisys are among the hundreds of companies who are facilitating the migrant detention and deportation machine. So all that cruelty is making money for these companies. Washington writes they've been raking it in from 2006 to 2018 more than a combined $45 billion. Cruelty is big money, dispersed among nearly 100,000 separate contracts with CBP and ICE. Besides being an enormous expenditure of taxpayer dollars, the sum also represents an unprecedented and ever-increasing reliance on for-profit companies in carrying out the government's immigration crackdown. He writes, immigration enforcement budgets have ballooned from $350 million in 1980 to $9.1 billion in 2003 to a whopping $23.7 billion in 2018, all going into what has become our border industrial complex. Those budgets then annually funnel $2.32 billion back to the private sector through federal immigration corrections and detention contracts. Two new reports, More Than a Wall, Corporate Profiteering and the Militarization of U.S. Borders by journalist Todd Miller and released by the Transnational Institute, and Detained for Profit, Spending Surges Under U.S. Immigration Crackdown by Alan Zibel and released by Public Citizen, detail which corporations are benefiting from the border cash cow, as well as how their lobbying efforts are pushing lawmakers to continue funding lucrative immigration enforcement. As Detained by Profit lays out, federal contract revenue for 10 major private corporations has risen 17% since Trump took office and is more than double what those companies earned in 2013. While the rise began under Obama's watch under Trump, quote, spending has ramped up even more as federal government has pressed ahead with sweeping efforts to constrain the flow of immigration to the United States, end quote. So, tearing apart families, destroying the lives of parents and children, causing horrific and cruel suffering is worth billions, billions and billions. As you may have heard on Democracy Now!, the climate change conference in Santiago de Chile has been canceled as the organizers scramble to find a new place for this year's event. This from Radio Havana, Cuba. Thousands of people once again took to the main streets of the Chilean capital and other cities in the middle of a call from the National Stop calling for the president's resignation and the approval of a new constitution. A total of 3,712 detainees and 1,233 injured are the balance of the National Institute of Human Rights record on the manifestations recorded throughout Chile in recent days. That's a machine translation. Manifestations, they mean protests. These figures were compiled by Human Rights directly from its observation in the demonstrations themselves at police stations and in health centers. In the capital, unlike the large demonstrations on Monday and Tuesday, and despite not having official permission, protesters marched peacefully through the Alameda today and passed in front of the La Moneda Palace, closely followed by a wide police deployment, but without the intervention of police forces. Previously, numerous groups marched through different streets of the center of the city to converge from 11 o'clock local time in the Plaza Italia, the Baquedano, from where they began to advance through the Alameda in a peaceful, festive, and vindictive atmosphere. I like that, peaceful, festive, and vindictive. However, apparently for fear of violence from previous days, unleashed by clashes between repressive forces and protesters, numerous metro stations and most commercial establishments in the area closed their doors. The demonstration was convened as a part of National Unemployment Wednesday, supported by the Social Unit Platform, which brings together more than 70 trade union and social organizations, including the Unitary Central of Workers, the National Association of Fiscal Employees, the College of Teachers, and trade union organizations. Also in Valparaiso, a massive march was convened by the Social Unit Platform, But unlike what happened in Santiago, in that important port city, there were intense clashes between protesters and special forces of Carabineros that prevented them from reaching the Congress headquarters. Participants in these mobilizations require the government, among other measures, to legislate immediately in favor of a substantial increase in the minimum wage for all workers and pensions, recognition of full freedom of association, respect for the right to strike, and guarantee of protected basic services and fair rates of public transport. And speaking for myself, after all these years of the Chicago School of Economics imposed under the Pinochet-Nixon-Kissinger regime, that would be quite a change, and it would go a long way to rationally distributing wealth to workers who have produced so much prosperity for Chile, almost all of which has been sucked up by the parasite class, by the extremely rich. So far, 20 deaths have been reported during the demonstrations, although according to the NHRI, only 5 directly correspond to the police action. Now, I have some local information. It's actually from earlier this month. I was traveling, but I wanted to get some of this to you. It's from Portland Press Watch. Dan Handelman addressing the city council. The PPB's 2018 annual report, excuse me, he wrote, reads a little less like a public relations document than the 8-page infographic reports that came out in past years. He had reports in scare quotes. To the Bureau's credit, they note the impact of 6 officer-involved shootings on the community, but they ignore the death and custody of Richard Berry. There are also no statistics about the use of force, the main focus of the DOJ agreement. There are multiple mentions of policing protests, but none about PPB's use of force at those events. Unlike the IPR report, the Bureau does reference the OIR group's 2018 report on deadly force incidents, but there are no specifics about changes made to Portland Police Bureau practices as a result of that report. And there's more to that, but I've run out of time because I want to go to a recording that I made at the Grassroots Radio Conference in Rochester, New York, and it was of an address by Glenn Ford, who is the co-founder, an amazing man, an historic agitator and broadcaster. You may be familiar with Black Agenda Report, as portions of his broadcast have been presented on KBOO over the years. Well, here is the man who put it together, and what he had to say was extremely inspiring, so I'm very glad to bring that to you now. This is Glenn Ford speaking in Rochester, New York, earlier this month.
Power to the people. I'm told that you are serious people, and I believe that. I've met some of you. I know that Rashida is an extremely serious person, and I believe her intrinsically. And I want to talk to you very seriously about Black radio news. And that is the door that I walked through about production as both a magnifier and an incubator of grassroots political movements. In fact, Black radio news was birthed by the Black mass movement of the 60s. It is a child of that movement and cannot be understood outside of that movement. And when the movement died, Black radio news almost died with it. Black radio news did not exist as a national force and a national institution before the great mass movement of the 60s. And it faded and went damn near extinct following the dismantling of that Black mass movement. Black radio news is therefore inseparable from the fortunes of the Black mass movement. The movement of you. You guys are involved in the dissemination of information. So what is the power of news? The news person acting as an editor, and every news person acts as an editor of a kind, decides what is important among the many events of the day. And he or she decides who are the most relevant people and the most relevant institutions to discuss those events of the day. News people decide who the credible sources are who are going to interpret these events of the day. News people decide who the key players are in the political arena, and they decide that by repeatedly calling on these particular players for comments about and in the news. That means that news people decide who the leaders of society are, because if someone is constantly called upon and put into the news, then the people assume that those people must be the leaders of something. It goes with the game. Now, of course, if you are reading somebody else's copy, if you are playing some corporate news feed, then you are allowing other people to decide what the issues and events that are most important are and who is qualified to speak on those issues and to comment on those events. Therefore, you are allowing those other people, those corporate news feeders, for example, to decide who the leaders of society are. When I first started talking on the radio, that's what I used to call it, full-time news people only existed at a very, very few stations, and those stations were located only in the very big markets. Most of the people who were called news people, even at those big markets, actually were just reading wire copy from United Press International and from the Associated Press. Some students of black radio say that by about the year 1958, there were 50 or 60 black radio stations. That is, radio stations whose programming was dedicated exclusively to the black audience. This has nothing to do with ownership. We're talking about black programming. In 1958, my father, his name was Rudy Rutherford, Rashida talked briefly about him. He called himself the Deuce. He was on the air for half an hour every night, starting at 10:30 on radio station WNJR in Newark, New Jersey. He wasn't on the staff of that station. He had a day job. Back in those days, it was very common that if someone could sell enough airtime to fill a broadcast slot, they could go on and be the announcer during that airtime. As long as they brought in the commercials, they could be in radio, but not necessarily on staff. So my father would hustle used car dealers and nightclubs in Newark and around northern New Jersey to get enough commercial time so he could be Rudy Rutherford, the radio announcer, for a half hour at 10:30 at night. The station did, of course, have announcers on staff, but only two of them were black. All the rest of the announcers were white. They had names like Sweet Daddy Santucci and Music Man Imperatelli, but they played black music, and of course they played jazz. So my father got frustrated after a while, selling all that airtime to used car dealers and only getting about half of it. And immediately, upon returning to Columbus, Georgia, he found work at the local black radio station. He also took his two sons down to Columbus, Georgia with him, so I got to observe all this stuff. When he went down to New Jersey, down to Georgia, he stole the radio persona of one of the greatest black disc jockeys of all time. This man should be on the Mount Rushmore of black radio, and his name was Jocko Henderson. He was hailing from Philadelphia, but at one time he was on the air live every day from Philadelphia and then from New York City. And he then got airtime to establish the first black dance show on television out of New York City and in Miami. Jocko Henderson was like a one-man syndication. As I said, he was the greatest black disc jockey of all time. So if my father had to steal somebody's persona, that was the man to steal it from. My father, as Rashida told you, called himself the Deuce. And as soon as he got that job at the local radio station in Columbus, Georgia, he went to the local television station and proposed, just like Jocko, that they do a dance show. And they went for the idea. And my father became the first black person in the country to have a non-gospel show in the Deep South because of that. They put the show on at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure that some people at the radio station, the young folks came from literally a 100-mile radius. They came from down in to the south in Florida. They came from the west, almost as far as Montgomery, Alabama, and from the east, as far as Macon, Georgia, and from the outskirts of Atlanta to the north. And they would load up on buses at midnight, because this was before the interstate, and spend hours on winding country roads just to get there at 6 o'clock in the morning to be on that show, rocking with the Deuce. They rode through the night as if it was a freedom ride. And I guess to many of them, it felt like that. And for establishing that program, my father got put in the Black Radio Hall of Fame. Now, I was watching all that just as his son. It wasn't all that exciting to me. But I used to hang around the radio station a lot because there's not much to do other than that in Columbus, Georgia. And my father would coerce and bully me into going on the air. Obviously, he wanted to produce another chip off the old block. But I didn't mind doing that, and I was bored anyway. And his listeners would call up and say, you know, Deuce, your daughter sure can read that news. Because my voice had changed. But when I went on the air, reading the news on these hourly 5-minute broadcasts, I read my own copy. I didn't read the AP wire copy, because I left a little bit out of the story. My mother and father met in the Communist Party. I'm a red diaper baby. I got my history from Herbert Dean of the East and from Leroy's writings on the subject, and not just on Black America, but on the condition of the world. And so I knew that the Associated Press and UPI and all of them were lying. And so I did a rewrite of the UPI copy every day. I didn't consider at that time, I had no ambitions to be in radio because there was no prospect at that time from my vantage point in Columbus, Georgia, that there would ever be a market for black radio news or for radio news on black radio, because it virtually did not exist. And it must be said at this point that there was not yet a mass demand for black news on black radio. And so the disc jockeys read, many of these wonderful jocks who were very good with the pattern could not read. I remember one of them who had great problems manipulating his mouth among words of more than a couple of syllables, who would just stop in the middle of reading the news and say, big word, big word, and then, and then move on. Now, in 1958, when my father got back to Georgia, and in 1961, when as an 11-year-old, I started reading the news, There had already been, of course, ongoing civil rights movement activity in various places. There, of course, as all of you know, you're a very learned crowd, there were lunch counter sit-ins and all kinds of direct action experiments trying to figure out how we're going to upset this Jim Crow. But John Washington, it was 4 years before black folks really kicked it off by burning down the Watts section of Los Angeles in 1965. So the civil rights movement, the black movement wave had not hit. But when it did hit around 1965, that's what it felt like. It felt like a wave of consciousness, a wave that roiled people. Once black folks started shaking up the country, started scaring white people and shouting down the man and arguing very loudly and publicly among themselves about something that they were calling liberation, using that word to accent the purpose of the movement, well, accompanying that was a demand for news. We must remember that in the year 1965, they were involved in these demonstrations or not, wanted to hear about them. They were demanding news. I'm talking about black people demanding news from the stations that they listened to. And they wanted to hear that news from other black people because that was the only source that they were going to trust during this period of mass movement activity. The demand for black-oriented radio itself, I'm not just talking about black news, but the demand for more black radio stations also exploded with the explosion of the movement. That is, with the explosion of direct action and burning of cities and all the manifestations of people who are upset. And along with that upsetment came a mass curiosity about what the next step is going to be. Researchers estimate that by 1966, there were, they think, about 100 black radio stations. My research says that there were probably about 120 by that time, which is twice as many as in the early 60s. By the time I got out of the Army in 1970, in the beginning of 1970, I estimate that there were at least 180 black-oriented radio stations. That phenomenal growth was directly related. It was, in fact, caused by the mass movement.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, and the speech that you're listening to was recorded by myself at the Grassroots Radio Conference in Rochester, New York, and I have just been so eager to bring this because it is an inspiring speech, and it's just amusing to me to hear the details of the things that came together to make the black radio phenomenon happen in the 70s. And you may have noticed that we have some interesting glitch. I was saying it sounds like Charles Wurinen got in there. He is, however, still, I think, in New York. So he did not corrupt my file. Something in the thumb drive apparently did. So we are going to try again, hopefully from approximately the same spot. And once again, you are listening to Glenn Ford, who produces Black Agenda Report, talking about the circumstances that brought about the heyday of black radio and why those dynamics apply to what we are now experiencing. So we'll go back to that.
During this period of mass movement activity, the demand for black-oriented radio itself, I'm not just talking about black news, but the demand for more black radio stations also exploded with the explosion of the movement. That is, with the explosion of direct action in Earth and burning of cities and all the manifestations of people who are upset. And along with that upsetment came a mass curiosity about what the next step is going to be. Researchers estimate that by about 1966, there were, they think, about 100 black radio stations. My research says that there were probably about 120 by that time, which is twice as many as in the early 60s. By the time I got out of the Army in 1970, in the beginning of 1970, I estimate that there were at least 180 black-oriented radio stations. That phenomenal growth was directly related. It was, in fact, caused by the mass movement that had marked the 1960s. And white money, investor money, responded to that movement by purchasing and establishing, rather, black radio stations. This, again, was not a phenomenon of black ownership. James Brown, in 1970, was the radio station king. He had more radio stations than any other black person. Three, one in Augusta, one in Knoxville, Tennessee, and one in Baltimore. And the Baltimore station was just a daytimer. But that was all. This phenomenon of the explosion of black radio was a white investor and black mass of folk affair. But virtually every top 50 black radio market had at least one black radio station, and many had several. But even small but heavily black cities and towns were likely to have a radio station, and if there was a radio station there, it was likely that they had a full-time newsman. For example, even a small town like Sparta, Georgia, which is the county seat of Hancock County, deep in the Black Belt, a very rural county, they had a full-time news reporter at the radio station. All of this had happened so quickly, just as the 60s movement seemed to happen so quickly itself. At the beginning of the decade, we saw a configuration that changed utterly by the end of the decade. All of a sudden, there was an institution, black radio news, that had not even existed before the advent of the mass movement. And so there were suddenly hundreds of young people who were acting as journalists on radio. And although not all of them were radical like me, but many of them were. And there was a culture, maybe it was a subculture, in black radio news of purposeful, very conscious radicality, that we were spreading information for liberation. And nobody was there with some kind of textbook to describe what black news is. And so we wrote that book ourselves. We decided how a black person in this new age was supposed to comport themselves on radio as a journalist. We wrote those rules, and we, for a time, had the right, the privilege, the liberty, the license to write those rules because we had a movement behind us that had called upon us to do this kind of work. The fuel that powered this explosion of black radio news was the mass black demand that the media that played our music and that employed those disc jockeys that spoke our language would also report on the black condition, locally as well as nationally and globally. Black people were voracious for information about themselves and about their communities, almost as if they had just discovered themselves. But of course, that is what real movements do. They change people through collective struggle. And folks that have been changed through movement work, through collective struggle, these newly black and proud, as James Brown said, people were deeply curious about their new selves. It was like they were looking in the mirror every day, but that mirror was this new media that they had called into existence. And that's why they demanded black news. This was the heyday of black radio news. You never know that you are in a heyday until it's gone. But 1970 and the next 5 years or so would be the apex of black journalism. Journalism on a medium that actually reached almost all of the black population. And that is also unique. The growth of black radio during the decade of the 60s had filled in virtually all of the spots on the black map. Everybody virtually had access to black radio, and as I said, almost all of those radio stations had news. They were all covered by a black signal. Black radio, despite being mostly white owned, had become a truly national black communications medium that reached almost every black American in the country. And most of those stations provided news of and by black Americans. Not only was black radio pervasive, but, and this is very important, no other demographic came close then or now to matching black listener loyalty to black radio. That is, black people listen to their radio more than any demographic listens to the radio that tries to serve them. This is an historic reality, and it continues even though overall listening to radio has declined with the proliferation of all these other platforms. Now, and that's why this may sound strange, because there are so many reasons not to listen to radio, so many other things to do than tuning in to a terrestrial station. But back to the period that we're examining. In the early 70s, 90% of the black population listened to the local black station. And that made these stations very, very attractive to investors. Advertisers were still blatantly discriminating against black radio. There was, in effect, what was casually called the 20% discount. That is, advertisers knew that they could look at the quoted rate of a spot on black radio and discount it 20% because the audience was black. And they got away with that. But still, because black listeners were so, and remain, so loyal to black radio, and there were so many non-black stations in any given market, black radio stations served a disproportionately large segment of the market. So they were in a strategically good position, although they were cheated every day by advertisers of a good rate. Before there was hip-hop, young people and older people listened to the same station, and the only outlier was the God people, and they listened to the local gospel station. And that made the black radio station even more important, especially politically, in that the young folks who are the most volatile politically, and the older folks who actually vote or listening to the same messages. So the political importance of these black radio stations was really immense. Black radio's audience was the whole community, and the whole community wanted their reporters, the ones they heard every day, to reveal to them who was on their side in struggle and who was worthy of support. So, when I got my first salaried job after leaving the Army, and that was again in January 1970 at James Brown's radio station in Augusta, Georgia, there was no question that my mission was to shake up that city thoroughly. But also, I didn't have any idea how I was going to do that, because that was my first job. I did know something, and that was that Augusta was a backwater. I knew that because Columbus, Georgia was very much like it. It's on the other side of the state. It was a backwater, too. The mass movement of the 60s had hardly touched Augusta, Georgia, and it hadn't touched Columbus, Georgia, either. Although people there had vicariously experienced the movement through the media. Augusta was a half-black city, but it didn't even have one city councilman, black city councilman. It was very much like Columbus, Georgia, where Rudy the Deuce was still on the air. There were cities, these were the cities, along with Macon, along with Savannah. These were the cities that Dr. Martin Luther King had been prevented from coming into by the local racist power structure, backed up by the black clergy. What folks, most people don't understand is that although the SCLC was considered a rump renegade section of the black clergy, Dr. King still adhered to the protocols of good Baptists, and he would not go into a city unless there was an invitation from another minister. You didn't just roll into a city uninvited and set up shop. But the fact was that throughout Georgia, and in fact throughout the South, most cities, ministers were adamant that Dr. King not come in. Their attitude was, we can handle our relations with the white folk. We don't need any outside people coming in here and roiling things up. The fact of the matter is that the preaching class had been collaborating with the white power structure all along. And so when you study up on Dr. King, you will see that his itinerary was actually dictated by those few places in which he could gain entrance because of an invitation. And in Georgia, that was just in the smaller city of Albany, because some preachers were fighting among themselves, and as part of their fight, one of them called in Dr. King, and then they hooked up with the students at the black college in Albany. And the same thing happened in Florida, where he was allowed to come to St. Augustine and basically nowhere else because of a dispute between preachers, one of whom pulled the trump card of Dr. King. But otherwise, he was locked out of these places. So Columbus was one, and Macon was one, and certainly Augusta was one. And I did understand that when I came into Augusta, Georgia. When I got there, it was still the dark of night, and the news director settled me in. He said, Glenn, there's your microphone, and there's your recording equipment, and oh, by the way, your name is Ford. They like monosyllable names in radio. So I was no longer Glenn Rutherford, I was Glenn Ford. And then he pointed to the wall, and there was a piece of paper taped to the wall, and he said, that's a list of all of the big black folks in town. And so whenever you need comment on a story that comes across the newswire, call one of those guys. I said, okay. and he left. And as soon as he left, I went to the list to see who all these important black folks were. And the first one was Reverend This, and the second was Reverend Doctor, and the third one was Bishop That, and the whole list was a theocracy. Every single one of them were clergymen. And I was enraged. I was not about to further empower these people who had been collaborating with the racist power structure all of this time. And so I ripped the list off the wall and crumpled it up and threw it into the wastebasket. And I spent the next week immersing myself in the real Augusta. I wanted to find the real leaders of Black Augusta, since Black Augusta had no other leadership visible except these black clergymen with which I had started. And the first thing I did was go into the public housing projects, because I knew that in there was a rather loud black woman who all of the other tenants respected and listened to. And I knew that I would find her because she's always there, and I did. And she became my contact person on housing and poor people's issues in general. And next, I went looking for that brother who jumps up every time the police beat down another brother. And he's always there. And I found him rather quickly too. And he became my contact person on issues of criminal justice. And the next item on the list was to find that black businessman who is so frustrated and tells everybody about how the city and the county never give black people contracts. And he, of course, was there too, and I found him quickly, and he became my economic development person. And then I went looking for the even more easy to find, frustrated black educator who's sick and tired of butting her head against the Jim Crow educational system, and I found that person too, and that became my person on education, and so on and so forth for that brief period of time, until I finally had about 7 or 8 people who I would treat as leaders. And I called them my committee of 10, even though there were only about 7 or 8. And each and every newscast that I did had one or more of these people commenting on the news and very quickly making demands for change. It, what really got to me was that in no time these people didn't need any coaching or prodding from me. They grew quickly, almost instantaneously, into the job of public leaders rather than street leaders. And that's because they really were leaders all along. In a little over a week, it was after I brought them on, it was clear to me that even though James Brown was only paying me $70 a week, which is like $50 after taxes, and he made you wear a suit and a tie, and I just got out of the army and I didn't have a suit and a tie, even though this was enforced poverty and very long hours and a boss that I truly did not like, I had discovered that with this microphone, I could change the political complexion of a medium-sized city and then move on to bigger things in terms of social transformation. That was my education. After a couple of weeks, I asked the committee of 10 what the big project was going to be. How are we going to really tackle these people? And they thought about it. I didn't have anything to do with it. They thought about it and shortly came back to me, and they decided that what was needed was a boycott of downtown businesses. Augusta, Georgia, like lots of cities in that region, the downtown shopping district was populated overwhelmingly by black shoppers, but most of the businesses there would not employ blacks on the floor, at least. What they were proposing was a don't shop where you can't work campaign, like Adam Clayton Powell Sr. and his son, Adam, used to run in Harlem in the 30s and 40s. And this is the 1970s. But that's how backward, how far back, what a backwater Augusta, Georgia was. And so that's what they wanted, and that's what we launched. And we launched it on radio station WRDW. When we put it out there, the community responded with tremendous enthusiasm. It was like an awakening of that Augusta black community. And in fact, the enthusiasm was so general and so intense that some of those preachers who were on the list that I had thrown away and discarded joined the movement to boycott the downtown businesses, and I had to put them back on the radio. And I was glad to do it. That was the test that was needed, and some of them passed that test. And one of them had one of the biggest churches in town. And I've been in touch with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Atlanta during this whole process. So I put the good preacher in touch with the SCLC, and his church was set for the event on the eve of the beginning of the boycott, the big event starring the SCLC and him. And on that night, that church was full to the rafters, and there were several hundred people who were waiting around outside. And the high point, as far as most of the crowd was concerned, was when James Brown sent word that he was flying in on his black jet. James Brown had a rented Learjet that he painted black. And whenever he would come into town, red lights would go off in the station, and a sound effect would go wrong, 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 and a disc jockey was required to go on the air and say, "The black jet is about to arrive, James Brown." You know. So he had one of his minions announce that he was coming in, and he was going to contribute $600 to a jail bail fund in case anybody went to jail. And the crowd just, they went wild because James Brown was their most famous son, and they all listened to his radio station. And here he was on the people's side, and they were just overjoyed. Everybody was happy in that church that night except me, because I knew something was up. And something was up because I knew that most of James Brown's biggest advertisers were those downtown merchants. And the question had always been, how is Mr. Brown going to react to this? But they were happy that night. And the next morning I went in to work. I got there at 6 o'clock in the morning as usual, and sat down to do the first newscast. I was already with it, with sound in the name of Augusta, Georgia's first mass movement event. But on the microphone was a note taped that said, "There will be no coverage of the downtown merchants boycott on this radio station." And it crushed me. And so, well, I didn't do any news. I just refused to do it. This is the news. How can I do a newscast when you said I can't do the news? This is the biggest news that has ever hit Augusta, Georgia, and I can't do it, so I guess there's no news. But I knew that James Brown was coming in. Folks told me that he wanted to talk to me. We had our talk. The station manager grabbed me and the program director grabbed him to prevent us from coming up to blows, which is very fortunate for me because James Brown could kick my ass. He's a hell of an athlete on stage and he's been a boxer. But it was decided that, yes, I should leave. And I got my severance pay and went back to New Jersey. But I kept up with what was happening in Augusta. The Committee of Ten did not stop because the boycott had been so based, so dependent upon the cooperation of the radio station, you know, me, to succeed, that fell through and collapsed. But the Committee of Ten, they were an entity now. They were about making a movement. And so they focused on, guess what? Criminal justice, of course. And so about 6 weeks after I left, I found that they had tried to organize a march through downtown Augusta. The mayor ordered his police to stop it. The police blocked the way. The marchers kept on coming, and the police fired on the crowd. And what followed was what they call the Augusta Riot Rebellion of 1970, in which several people were killed, and the racist Governor Lester Maddox flew in. He was accompanied by James Brown doing his accommodationist, collaborationist bit to tamp down the rebellion. Now, I wasn't there for the Augusta Rebellion, but I claim it as mine, because it would not have happened had I not set foot there and had I not been Black radio news. And so the next year, I'm in Columbus, Georgia again, and I decided I was going to have another rebellion. This time, the chemistry was that the Black police, there had been an influx, a big influx of Black police into police departments around the country related to the Vietnam War, because you could get out early if you joined the police department during those days. And as they were scaling down the Vietnam era army, they were handing out these early outs, that's what we call them, a lot of them. And lots of Black soldiers took advantage of them and went into these police departments. So in Columbus, Georgia, there was a big influx of Black cops under these early outs. Remember, these are all Vietnam vets, and they are children of the 60s as well. And they organized a chapter of the recently formed National Association of Black Police Officers. And their main beef was not some internal or work-related complaint. It was about police brutality. That was how they immediately started organizing. So, and that was strange to me, because I was back in Georgia after being in the Panther Party for a period, and working with police of any kind. It was strange. But I understood these brothers, because I'd also just left the army. And I hooked them up with the real leaders. Basically, I was replicating the same strategy that I employed in Augusta in Columbus, which was a very, very similar city. And so I put these organized police persons in touch with the real leadership of civilian Black Augusta. And I'm not going to take a long time to talk about that period, except to say that what we got in this process was the longest period of sustained civil disturbance ever in the United States. All of my research says that what I just said is true. The longest period of sustained civil unrest in the United States. Something burned every night in Columbus, Georgia, and they couldn't figure out who was burning it. And the reason they couldn't figure out who was doing the burning was because it was the black police officers. And they were getting the accelerant from the black soldiers at Fort Benning right next door.
All right, and the moral of this story is if you use community radio right, change can happen. And he made that point really very well. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, going out to you 90.7 FM in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea. Stay tuned for Flashpoints.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up next on Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein looks at the connection between Pacific Gas and Electric and the California wildfires.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stop the Climate Crisis and War on Tuesday, November 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland. Stop the Climate Crisis and War is a forum and panel discussion which will link the issues of climate change and war, update the community on U.S. belligerence in Iran and Venezuela, focus on the U.S.'s role in the war on Yemen and presence in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, and more. Again, that's Stop the Climate Crisis and War on Tuesday, November 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Augustana Lutheran Church, 2710 Northeast 14th Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland.